This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. We hope you are enjoying the holiday season. Today's show is a rebroadcast from earlier this year. The Battle Creek Inquirer's ebook, We Are One, chronicles issues of racism and the efforts to combat it in Battle Creek. It also looks back at the city's long and complicated history on the subject of race. Justin Hinckley is a reporter for the Battle Creek Inquirer. He edited the ebook and wrote the foreword. For our interview recorded in October of this year, we were also joined by J.R. Reynolds, the director of the Calhoun Race Impact Alliance. Reynolds also occasionally contributes reports on hip-hop to WMUK's Arts and More. Justin, let me begin with you. Where does this title come from?
It comes from a march that happened in October of 2012. There was a shooting near Battle Creek Central High School that caused the school to have to cancel their homecoming celebrations, and the kids were really hurt about that. And then there were some online commenters from our story on that shooting who were basically blaming all of the kids at Central for all this violence that was happening downtown and called all of the kids thugs and gangbangers. And one person online even said, well, we should just tear down that whole school. And that really hurt the kids, and they decided that they were going to have a march, a rally, to sort of redefine themselves in the eyes of the community. And it turned out that lots of area schools across the whole city and some parts of the county joined, and there was some 2,000 people that marched through downtown Battle Creek, and the school started calling it We Are One. And so that's where I took the title from.
JR has efforts like We Are One. Have those efforts helped advance the conversation or maybe at least started some sort of a dialogue about race and the way we view it?
Yeah, definitely it has. Credit the Inquirer and other publications for helping to create awareness that it happened. And then also the school systems, because in the march, it wasn't just Battle Creek Public Schools that marched. Justin probably knows better than I do who all participated, but I know that Lakeview Schools, Harper Creek Schools, Penfield, they all sent students over, and I think they came as far as Marshall.
Marshall did,
Justin. Yeah, so there are a lot of students that took up the mantle and empathized with the issue and supported Battle Creek Central High School.
Justin, you start this book with a story about yourself in fourth grade. Let's make sure we're clear here. This is fourth grade, a while ago for all of us, and all of us have done things between fourth grade and adulthood that we wish we could take back. But it also is a story that could be somewhat embarrassing about something that you did in class that was racially insensitive, I guess we could say. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose to include that?
Because I think part of the conversation, if you're going to talk about race and racism, we all have made mistakes. You cannot have those conversations without making mistakes, without hurting somebody's feelings. And I think when you learn from the people who are involved in this work about how you have these conversations, you have to just not be afraid to admit those mistakes, make those mistakes, admit them, talk about why you made them, and you can learn from that and move on from that. And so, you know, I just really think that it kind of puts that out there that it's okay to make those mistakes, and we can't be afraid to have the conversation for fear of those mistakes.
I don't recall the specific story it's in, but there's a conversation between an African-American gentleman and a realtor, and the realtor admits that he steered African-Americans away from predominantly white neighborhoods. But as you say, the fact that they were able to have this conversation and acknowledge that this had happened was helpful.
Absolutely. Tim Wise is a speaker on race issues who came in and spoke to the Albion and Marshall students when their high schools merged. And that's one of the things he says. He says, we will mess up, but the research says and experience says that it's better to do that than to do nothing.
I have to chime in and agree with what Justin says. So I've had some deep training regarding issues relating to race and, frankly, a lot of the different isms, sexism, homophobia, ableism. A lot of people don't realize just how hard it is for disabled people to get around and just how much able-bodied people take for granted. But I have a column in the Battle Creek Inquirer called Humans Being. some of the fodder that I use is from my own life. And as studied as I am in issues relating to race, I get it wrong a lot. And a lot of it speaks to something that's called implicit bias. It's like stuff that just is running in the background all the time in your mind that has created frameworks for the way that you live your life in the world. And so a lot of that stuff has been just instilled in you either from childhood or through the media or through just your ways of living. So you have these ways of thinking about stuff, and then you get out there in the world and something happens that is offensive when you think about it, but in the moment it's like either something that you might think is funny or it's something that you think, oh my God, I can't comment, or did that really happen? And you just let it go. So for him to put that up in the front of his book, and then how I do it in my column, talking about those missteps, I think that it helps folks to see that it's okay to, maybe not okay, but that everybody stumbles, no matter how learned you are about this work.
And of course, it's one thing to stumble. I suppose it's another thing if that realtor we mentioned continues that practice. To recognize the mistake is one thing, but correcting it at some point has to be part of this equation, right?
Yeah, it does. And there's something that's called institutional racism, and that's sort of what was happening with regards to the realtor. I don't know the specifics of that case, but I know that there are like policies and procedures in different organizations that are either designed specifically to exclude certain people, or they've just been created, and over the years, the way that they've been written end up creating conditions where there's barriers for certain people, like in this case, people of color, to not be able to participate or to receive fair and equitable treatment.
And I think that sometimes people, we all make those mistakes without realizing it. And so talking about it, and the reason I put that story up front is to say, like, you know, we all make these kind of mistakes. Someone hopefully can read that maybe and say, oh yeah, maybe I said something at some other point. And so you have to talk about it and realize the mistakes that you're making before you can do anything different.
And to take that story a little further, your mother made you write a letter of apology. And as you say, the first time out, it didn't cut it.
Yeah. I wrote a letter of apology to my teacher. And the first letter that I wrote, I sort of blamed it all on this other student. And it's sort of this, it's almost a something that I think especially white men are sort of born with, to say, you know, well, this is the situation, and I didn't really mean to do it, and, you know, you guys shouldn't be upset because it was all just an accident. I can explain it away. And my mom just ripped that letter right up, and I still say to this day, that's the most important lesson that she taught me, is she said, it doesn't matter what other people did, you need to own up to your role in this, and you need to apologize to the teacher for what you did and how your actions hurt her. And so I did that, and I think that's something that, you know, like you said, when you talk about correcting the mistake, you have to own up to the mistake too. And you have to talk about your responsibility and not try and explain it away.
Another story we should talk about is the noose incident.
Yeah.
Justin, what happened?
Well, this was February of 2012, and it was in the parking lot at the Calhoun Area Career Center. There was a group of students who were black from Battle Creek Central, and a group of students who were white from Marshall High School had been having some issues. And one day, as the Central students were walking into the Career Center, the Marshall student was in his truck. He had this leather shoestring fashioned into the shape of a noose, and he used that to taunt these students. And that really was one of, there were a couple of other incidents, but that was one of the incidences that really sparked this whole community conversation about race, because the students were really hurt by that, and they took it up with the local branch of the NAACP, and it got the schools talking about, you know, how should we respond to incidents like this. So I would really say that was a big igniter for these conversations happening.
JR, this probably leads us into a conversation about how much of this is a culture of racism or acceptance of racism, and how much of it is the actions of individuals. Can something as offensive as this happen in a community which we could largely view as tolerant otherwise?
Yeah, these kinds of things happen all the time. I don't know the mindset of the kid, the youth that was involved in this incident, but many times someone will do something that they just think is funny because they've seen stereotypes out there, and it's like, oh, this will be a gag. But what they may not realize is the context of what they consider as humor is something that's catastrophic and extremely hurtful and oppressive for the person on the receiving end. So there's lots of times when folks will just say off, I was going to say off color, but that's a pun, but they'll say things that are
insensitive.
And they see it as funny. And from their perspective, yeah, maybe it is. But a lot of times what's not happening is you're not really looking at things from the other side of it. One thing that, and I'm straying a little bit again into sexism, but everybody's heard blonde jokes. And so until I really started studying sexism and married a woman who's a feminist, somebody tell a blonde joke, I'd snicker, or I'd look and or not say anything and appreciate the humor in it, not realizing that there are people that are actually blonde who have to listen to that stuff over and over and over and over. It seems funny on my end because I'm not blonde and I'm not a woman, but for that person that is that way, it can begin to take its toll. Become very oppressive in ways that the person that's telling the joke or the people that are participating in by laughing or by not saying something, it turns into to something that just over time really, really affects people who are the butt of those jokes.
I wonder, though, as we talk about, you know, jokes, those for some people, they may seem to be kind of harmless because they're just out there and people laugh, and it may not seem to be. When you compare it to someone holding a noose, it doesn't seem as bad. But the noose gets a reaction from a lot of people, whereas those jokes bit by bit often don't get a reaction. As you say, a lot of people who otherwise are pretty open-minded will snicker at some of these things. And I'm wondering if maybe the noose incident, you don't want to minimize the impact of the students who were there, but does it help, again, get the conversation rolling in a way that maybe other things don't?
Yeah, the blonde jokes have been around for so long that it's just a matter of course. But a noose thing, I think there are people that do appreciate and understand the history of how lynchings were a real difficult thing that was going on in the mid-20th century, even deeper as late as the 60s, maybe the 70s. But that type of thing to happen created conditions for there to be conversation. Justin might want to talk a little bit about what the Kellogg Foundation has done in regards to promoting a series of learning labs that have been happening in the Battle Creek community that have helped to forward the race conversation.
I think by the time the noose incident had happened, the Kellogg Foundation had sent a number of community members through this learning lab experience called White Men and Allies. And it's from a group that kind of you really learn to talk about white privilege and male privilege and how to have these difficult conversations. And I think one of the reasons I say that was an igniter is that there was this nexus of people, small but it has grown since then, that we're ready to talk about that. You know, in the past, something like that might have happened. There would have been a story in the paper about it, and there would have been discipline handed out, and it kind of would have dropped from there. But people kept talking about it, and people kept talking not just about that incident, but what does that say about our schools? What does that say about what our kids understand about the past? What does that say about what our kids understand about how their actions impact others? The Kellogg Foundation has now sent, I think, more than 100 people through this Allies Lab, including myself. And there's just people out there that are talking about it and are willing to grab onto these things and push them all the way out as far as they can.
This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Today we are rebroadcasting a program that originally aired in October. The guests are Battle Creek Enquirer reporter Justin Hinckley, who is the editor of the e-book We Are One, and J.R. Reynolds, director of the Calhoun Race Impact Alliance. There are constant references to history throughout this e-book, including the entire last section of the book. What do these stories about Battle Creek's history in regards to race tell us about where things are at in 2013?
Just speaking of myself, you know, I grew up in Battle Creek, and you learn about Sojourner Truth and you learn about the Underground Railroad and the role that Battle Creek played. And you see Battle Creek as this very, very tolerant place, this very, very understanding place, this place where people are equal. And you kind of think, you know, you're growing up, this is not the Deep South where racism still is very prevalent. And you think, oh, we're just beyond this. But if you really dig into the past and you see that we also are a very segregated city, and you can just look at a map from as recently as 2010 to see that, you know, minorities are very, very segregated. Poverty is very, very segregated. And you can go back and you can look at John Harvey Kellogg and his Race Betterment Foundation that talked about eugenics and how there was, you know, very high up these people who were promoting ideas that people of color were inferior. You can go back and look at, you know, the whole Bottoms issue and the displacement of the black community that was there. If you really go in and dig into the past, you see that it's not as bright and shiny as you learn it growing up here. And so I think what that tells you is, I think we're a community that kind of likes to talk about the things that are going really, really well and doesn't want to talk about the things that are going not so well. And so you have to go back and talk about all of that. Otherwise, you can't move beyond those things. You know, if you don't talk about why our neighborhoods are still so segregated, you can't ever get past it.
And as you say in writing about that history, it's complicated. For instance, the whole story of John Harvey Kellogg and Sojourner Truth puts a very different light on what he did personally, right?
Yeah, because John Harvey Kellogg, you know, he had this Race Betterment Foundation. He was talking about those things, but, you know, he was a medical doctor, and he supposedly treated Sojourner Truth when she was sick, and even used some of his own skin to do a graft when she needed one. And so it's a very, very complicated past, but it is all of those things. It is not just one thing, and we have to talk about all of that. We have to celebrate the past, the good past, and really dig deep on the bad past and figure out how we can move past that.
I think you can bring that down all the way to the individual as well. You know, there might be a person who thinks of himself, well, I'm not prejudiced or I'm not racist, you know, and talk about the buddies that they have, that they hang out with at work or go to the game with. But then, you know, when they're in their living room and something they see something in the news or something happens out, you know, that they read in the paper, they start to make statements that are decidedly prejudiced or even racist. And maybe do it unintentionally, intentional or not intentional. So there's this complexity that individuals have. And that's probably the biggest thing that represents the biggest challenge that I have with the work that I do is that well-intentioned people have prejudices that they might not even be aware of. And so that's the challenge, is getting them to confront and face that. Everybody has these prejudices that are inside them. The trick is to help to bring an awareness of them, of those prejudices that are inside you, so that when things happen on the outside, you're able to look at stuff and react to it in ways that are more balanced and not just do that knee-jerk reaction like I used to do with blonde jokes.
To add to that, I think a perfect example is those people who went online after the shooting near Central and they said that, you know, all those kids at Central are thugs and gangbangers. They very likely do not consider themselves prejudiced people. And they say, well, you just have to look at the numbers. Look at the numbers. If you look at the school safety statistics, Battle Creek Central has, you know, statistics that are worse than other districts in the area. Look at the police and fire reports. You know, where do those burglaries happen? Where do those shootings happen? And they think that they can justify that just by looking at the numbers, and they're not prejudiced. They're just calling it like they see it.
They're not saying anything about race. They're talking about
right.
The crime.
Exactly. But what they don't do then is they don't look back, like I said, at that past and how did all those people end up in the positions where they are. And I think one of the most powerful things, Star Commonwealth has a racial healing training that they do called Glasswing. And one of the things they say that is, if you're not helping to solve the problem, you're contributing to the problem. So for those people to sit far away from the hardships of these kids and these families and to cast judgment, if they're not doing anything to solve the issues that are contributing to that, they're actually contributing to the problem.
Kind of reminds me of like back in the early part of the 20th century, there were a lot of lynchings that were happening mainly in the South, but don't get it twisted. There were things that were happening up north as well. So we're not off the hook up here up north. But they used to have lynch parties. And so there were only a core number of folks that actually participated in the actual lynching and stringing up of a human being. But what actually happened was they would have a place and they'd know where the place was. There would be people that would set up vendor booths to take advantage of all the people that would come in. And then there would be people from all over the community who would come in to witness this happening. They weren't the ones that were actually doing the actual lynching and stringing up, but they were a party to it by just coming to it, being there, and not saying anything. Again, this is like an extreme example of how you can be a part of something and do nothing and then feel like you're absolved of it. But you are culpable and have an accountability. Even when the minorest of things happen, like in a grocery store, when somebody gets treated in a way that is either racist or prejudiced or discriminatory.
So if we look at the whole complicated picture of race present day, where are the bright lights in the Battle Creek area in Calhoun County? What are the things we look at and we say, hey, that's a sign of some real progress in terms of race?
I think in the Marshall and Albion merger, the fact that the superintendents of those two districts, they didn't just throw these kids together and see what happened. They were very, very intentional about, you know, bringing the kids together for this summit over the summer. They had the Star Commonwealth Glasswing conversations there. They talked about race and they were upfront about it. And not only was it the superintendents in the school districts, but there were people in the community who were coming in to help make this thing work. And I think that's a bright spot. There are superintendents, Dave Peterson in Lakeview, for example, he's really trying to look at the systems that are in place in his district, which has a reputation for being a place that is unfriendly to persons of color, and say, you know, are we doing everything we can? Are there any barriers that we're not even conscious of that are preventing students of color from participating in our programs? And so I think there's lots of little things like that happening that are definitely worth celebrating.
JR?
Yeah, I'd like to echo what Justin said. I think that people are stepping up to a greater degree. There are more conversations about what's happening. The learning lab that the Kellogg Foundation has generously been providing to the community has been creating a contingent of people who are more aware that these sorts of issues need to be talked about. And so that when there are issues that are out there, you know, we'll get together, maybe not as a huge group, but two or three of us and talk about something that happened and then maybe make plans for action. Another thing, I'm a part of the local food movement in Greater Battle Creek. And one of the things that we're doing is laying the groundwork to have a series of workshops that talk about issues related to food access, or rather in access for people of color, particularly in low-income communities. It's not just people of color, because folks in a lot of low-income communities don't have access to fresh, quality food. But the fact of the matter is these food deserts, like we refer to them, are largely based in areas that contain people of color. So this organization, Good Food BC, which is funded by Fair Food Network out of Ann Arbor, is doing a series of workshops to talk about racial equity as it relates to the food system. So that's an example of a place where this work is going on that is not so quite apparent, you know, on the surface. Well, why are you talking about race and food? Well, this workshop will help you to understand the need for such a workshop and that kind of work.
So on the flip side of that question, what are the most troubling signs that there is not the progress we want to see or not progress being made in the area of racial equality?
I think schools of choice is one area where you can look, where I did a story that is included in the book about how schools of choice has created this sort of new white flight. If you look at the list of school districts across Michigan that are going into deficit and having real issues financially, a lot of that is caused by schools of choice. And a lot of what's going on with schools of choice is families that are more privileged that are able to take their students and drive them to another school district are doing so. And kids who don't have those means are left behind in districts that now have real, real money problems and are doing things like cutting extracurriculars, you know, charging students to participate in sports, all these different kinds of things that are going on. And so I think there's still a lot of those really big systems kind of issues that have to be addressed. There has to be some policy that tries to make it more of an equal playing field when you're looking at how kids access education.
And would schools of choice have been a big factor in what happened in Albion?
Oh, absolutely. They have more than half of the kids who live within Albion Public Schools but go to other districts. And that's been going on for a decade, and that's really the main reason that they ended up where they did. You can say different things, and some people will say, well, there's, you know, what did they do with the money that they had and all of that. But when you've got, you know, 600 kids times $7,000 just going out the door, it's really hard to make up for that.
JR?
Two things that jump out for me. One is hiring practices, and then the other is rates of incarceration. With regard to employment, there are businesses that are out there, actually factories, that they're woefully low in the rates of hiring of people of color. I took a tour of one factory, not related to the work that I do, but I was doing some other sort of volunteer work, and it just occurred to me as I was walking through that I didn't see any people of color in the shop. And this place employed hundreds. Now, there may have been folks of color in there. I didn't see them. And just my interpretation of what I saw was that I think there's about, what, Justin, 20% or 17%?
I think it's about 20%. I don't know if that's African-American specifically, but it's 20 to 30% people of color in Battle Creek.
So it's a decent number of folks. But when I'm in this factory touring, I just did not see that representation in that particular factory. So that's one issue. The other is rates of incarceration. I don't have like county statistics, but nationally, there's a disproportionate number of people of color who are incarcerated in this nation compared to folks that are white. It's a systematic problem. I do know that in Calhoun County, there are judges that are really starting to pay attention to this issue and are thinking about these sorts of issues as they have people appear in front of their bench. But again, back to the national level, for instance, and I guess a lot of people have heard the statistics, but for the same crime, African Americans are being incarcerated for much longer periods of time than a white person who gets convicted of the same crime. And why is that? So that's something that's troubling.
I'd like to add, you can see both of those issues playing out in public schools as well. You can look at rates of suspension and expulsion, and students of color are far more likely to be suspended or expelled. And I have a story coming out on October 27th looking at the fact that while 20% of students across the area are of color, only 3% of teachers are of color. So you see both of those things where there's underrepresentation at the systems level.
I was just going to say on the positive side, I want to give credit to a lot of white men who are stepping up and recognizing these issues despite the fact that they're in places of privilege where if they choose not to, they don't even have to see or they don't have to think about or they don't have to address these terrible issues that are happening. But like Justin or there's others that are out in the community. I don't want to start cherry picking the ones that I'm closest to, but they're doing incredible work to help to lift up awareness of and then addressing these kinds of issues.
J.R. Reynolds is the director of the Calhoun Race Impact Alliance. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
And Justin Hinckley is a reporter for the Battle Creek Inquirer. He also edited the ebook We Are One and wrote the foreword as well. Thank you, Justin.
Thank you.
The interview with Justin Hinckley and J.R. Reynolds was recorded and originally aired in October of this year. can find links with more information, including how to order the ebook We Are One, at our website, wmuk.org. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.